We'll call the Senate Tax Committee to order for February 26, 2015. Welcome, members. We're going to start working through a number of members' bills this morning, and so we will start with Senator Bonhoff, Senate File 555. Welcome, Senator Bonhoff.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members. Senate File 555 does have an author's amendment, the A1.
Senator Marty moves. Is this the first stop for you, Senator
Bonhoff?
Yes, it is. Senator Marty moves the A1 amendment. Any discussion? I assume it's in your packet, members. Mm-hmm. All those in favor say aye. Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. The A1's adopted.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Last biennium, the legislature adjusted the date that city and county auditors must report the proposed property tax levy for taxes payable in the following year. As you know, because that was the work of this committee, it was pushed back from September 15th to September 30th. However, this provision did not include special taxing districts. So this resulted in a bifurcated reporting mechanism for certain cities and counties, which became problematic for those jurisdictions. So I have here today Luke Fisher with the City of Plymouth, he is the Administrative Services Director, to speak about that, as well as Gary Carlson, the Director of Intergovernmental Relations for the League of Minnesota Cities. Oh, and members, the amendment, just to clarify, was just to make sure that while it does within the bill say that this does not apply to the Met Council or the Metropolitan Mosquito Control Commission, it was then discovered that they're actually governed in a separate section of law, and so the amendment just clarifies that within that section of law it does not apply this bill.
Thank you, Senator Bonhoff. And so what you're doing is bringing all of these special taxing districts into the same time frame as everyone else is, except for two, the Metropolitan Council and the Metropolitan Control
Mosquito
Commission.
Yes, exactly.
And those are unnecessary. Any questions, members, of Senator Bonhoff? Mr. Carlson, or whoever's first.
Mr. Fisher.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you very much for the opportunity to come today and talk about this really relatively minor and technical clarification that's being proposed that would really help cities streamline our process as we prepare to file our preliminary levies each year. The adjustment that was made last year to move the preliminary levy filing date from September 15th to September 30th really afforded cities a lot more time to prepare a proposed tax impacts to taxpayers as we finalized our preliminary budgets. There's a certain scramble that happens every year at the beginning of September as cities wait for tax capacity calculations from counties. That tax capacity is used to estimate tax impacts, and that's important for us as we share our budget information each year with taxpayers. The bill before you just brings into alignment our HRA and EDA preliminary levy filing dates, which really helps clarify the process at a staff level and reduces the potential for administrative error with a single filing date, which we think is important. Also for taxpayers, it's just a little bit more clear that there's a single date that everything gets filed. As the senator alluded to, this is really a minor and technical issue from our perspective, but it would be help clarify our process and make things much easier. I'd be happy to answer any questions that you may have.
Thank you. And members, I see we have the FFA joining us today. I think it's FFA Day on the Hill. So welcome the folks in the blue coats when you see the blue jackets when you see them. So welcome to the Tax Committee, FFA members. Any questions, Mr. Carlson?
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Gary Carlson. I'm with the League of Minnesota Cities. I just want to thank Senator Bonhoff for offering this bill and a little apologize to the committee that we did not make this change last year when we changed the city and county levy certification dates. Once the cities went through the process last year, they realized that we should have probably changed the date for the special districts as well, and that's why we're bringing this bill forward. So we do support the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Carlson. Anyone else that wish to testify? Mr. Carlson.
Mr. Chairman, members, I'm Keith Carlson, Executive Director of the Minnesota Intercounty Association that consists of 10 of the regional center counties of Greater Minnesota and 4 here in the metro area. I also want to thank Senator Bonhoeff for introducing this bill. Hopefully it's been made clear by this testimony so far, this will accommodate the fact that frequently county boards, both CIT has the county board as well as the HRA or the water management organization. So the change in the date for just the counties and the cities last year did not really accomplish the transparency I think that the legislature would want, that all property tax decisions are made at one time, or at least for purposes of the preliminary levy. This will accomplish that objective, and we support the legislation.
Thank you, Mr. Carlson. Any questions, members? Senator Senja.
Mr. Chair, not to Mr. Carlson, but unless we're off.
I think we're wrapping up, so Senator Senja.
Well, Mr. Chair, I don't know if there's a township person in the audience, but it's noted the bill leaves only towns with a September 15th certification date, and it seems to me that all the arguments I've heard would apply for townships as well. Is there a reason? That's the question.
Senator Senja, I asked the same question. I think it's because the townships do their levy at their annual meeting in the spring, and this would not have any impact.
Okay.
On that.
Thank you.
Anything else? Anyone else wish to testify in Senate File 555? Senator Bonhoeff, anything else?
No, thank you very much.
Thank you, Senator Bonhoeff. We will lay Senate File 555 over, as amended, over for possible inclusion. Thank you. Senator Laurie, Senate File, you have two bills. Do you have a preference, Senator Laurie?
Senate File 207, a second on the agenda. We can go with that one.
Senate File 207.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Senate File 207, and I'm just going to do, I notice a few people signed up to testify, I believe all in favor of the bill. I didn't organize anyone, but I will just tell you the mechanics of it and then let individuals tell you why we think it's a good idea. The bill would really create a new state aid.
And Senator Laurie, when you're in your discussion, there was an amendment added in Health and Human Services, if you could address that briefly also.
Sure. The amendment added in Health and Human Services was to include corrections as a mode of out-of-home care placement, really, is what was added. And it did increase the costs some from the original informal fiscal note. So it really just the amendment added changed the definition of what out-of-home care placement is, in line with how this, you know, this is a drafted based on a bill, a law that used to exist, and this was the construct that it had in its original form, and that piece was important, the corrections piece, as included in the definition of out-of-home care placement, and in our original draft, it did not include that.
Okay. Okay, thank you, Senator Laurie. Senator Laurie.
So, again, it would create a new state aid payment to counties for costs related to the out-of-home placement of children under the Indian Child Welfare Act. The aid payment would be 100% of the non-federal share of costs incurred by a county social service agency or correctional agency for out-of-home placement. Based on a 3-year average, these costs would be reported to and certified by the Department of Human Services and the Department of Corrections, and the payment to counties would be made in 2 equal installments each year on July 20th and December 26th by the Department of Revenue. It actually wouldn't have a fund impact until the 18-19 biennium, and at that point it would be a net general fund cost of just over $17 million per year. And of that, in the bill, it goes through and explains that the original bill was 13.5, and then when we expanded it to include corrections side, it increased by another 4.4, bringing the total to the 17 that we have before you. And with that, you know, to talk in detail, in a little bit more detail about the background and why we think this is a good idea, maybe I'd ask Commissioner Patrick Boyle, the chair of the Public Health and Human Services piece from St. Louis County, to give some perspective.
Thank you, Senator Lori. Again, my name is Patrick Boyle, and I'm coming today to you with two different hats on, one as county commissioner in the biggest county on the east side of the Mississippi River in St. Louis County, and number two, I'm also a nurse practitioner, and I've been proud to work with the Fond du Lac Reservation for the past 8 years. As you well know, and again, I thank Senator Lori for bringing this up to discussion, St. Louis County puts in around $3.6 million into out-of-home placement for the Native American population. We are proud to have Boys Fort and Fond du Lac as part of our county. And, you know, as you well know, we as a state are on the bottom rung of partnershipping with counties. This is all coming out of our county budget, this $3.6 million. We will continue to fund this. It's extremely important and will be in the future, but we need a partner in this. So we are, again, looking for the state for some help on this in the time being. Thank you.
Senator Lori or Mr. Boyle, the placements that are being made, are they being made by tribal courts or by county courts? And that would be the question then for the correction component also.
Mr. Chair, I'll for an Indian child welfare case, typically a child protective case is open, and the federal ICWA law requires that the tribal courts be able to intervene and take over the administration of that case. And the feds do participate in part of the costs, but whatever else is left falls on the county today 100% to pick up the tab for this case that has been removed from their jurisdiction. Typically. And so what we're saying here is we'd like the state to be a partner in helping for the financial management of these cases that are taken over by the tribal courts.
And Senator Lori, what is what percentage would the state be responsible for if this bill was to become law?
This bill is proposing to pick up 100% of the non-federal share of the costs.
Okay. Very good. Any questions, members? Senator Sanjum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. But Senator Lori, just to maybe follow up, 100% of the, you're going to pick up all of the federal cost?
All of the non-federal costs.
So, Senator Mr. Chair, do you have any sense, Senator Lori, what the percent of that is? Is this 50-50 or 75-25, or do you have any just broad estimate or thoughts?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Lori or Mr. Boyle?
I'd turn it over to Mr. Boyle.
Commissioner Boyle?
You know, right now we're looking for any partnership. Anywhere where the state can help out with local governments, including the counties, would be a step in the right direction for us.
Maybe to clarify the question, does the federal government pay about 50% currently?
Yes.
Okay.
Senator Sanjum? Anything else, members? Thank you, Mr. Boyle. Anyone else wish to testify? I have Mr. Carlson and Ms. Westland.
Mr. Chairman, members, I'm Welcome, Keith Carlson again from the Minnesota Intercounty Association, and full disclosure, St. Louis County is a member of our organization. I do want to make it clear that while the counties with Indian reservations are particularly affected by this, this applies to placement of Native Americans throughout Minnesota. Scott County, Hennepin County would certainly have individuals that would qualify under this legislation. Just to make it clear to the membership of the committee, this is one of the mandates that are placed on counties and for which we receive no direct compensation from the state. So we would welcome the assistance that would be provided under this bill. And thanks, Senator Lori, for advancing it. That'll conclude and answer any questions.
Questions of Mr. Carlson? Ms. Westland.
Thank you. Good morning, Mr. Chair and ladies and gentlemen of the committee. I am Rochelle Westland. I'm the Health and Human Services Policy Analyst with the Association of Minnesota Counties. AMC represents commissioners in all 87 counties throughout Minnesota. And as you know, counties play an integral role in the delivery of state mandated human services programs, of which this is one of them. one of our greatest areas of responsibility is child protection, and out-of-home placement falls under our child protection costs. We really appreciate Senator Lori's leadership in supporting counties in this important work with this Senate file. Out-of-home placement is one of the greatest costs of child protection as far as the cost to counties. For example, counties such as Beltrami have a per capita spending of $831 for children's services. And as you can imagine, this places a high demand on county costs and county social services. Unfortunately, many Native American children in the child protection system end up in out-of-home placement. And when placing a Native American child specifically, counties must look beyond its borders to find placements to keep the child connected to their tribe. Counties support this as a principle, but recognize that it is an additional burden that is placed on the counties. This bill provides counties with financial backing that helps shift local discussions from how to finance these out-of-home placements to focus on determining what best support systems are available to the child. It allows for further collaboration between the counties and the tribes, and it allows children to be placed in the most culturally appropriate places so that they can receive services that help integrate traditional healing for their best chance at success. So AMC is very supportive of this bill, and thank Senator Lori for bringing it forward.
Senator Lori.
So that's everyone that signed up to testify. I need to say also that I think most members are aware there's a great deal of attention being paid to Child Protective Services right now. And we have a task force. We have an initial set of recommendations that we're working through the Health and Human Services committees. And we're taking them very seriously. There are additional recommendations that will come forth as well. I think sometime in March is the current schedule for those to come forward, and we will be contemplating that. And there will be additional costs to the counties for implementation of these child protective services. And we're going to be looking for many mechanisms to help defray the cost that counties bear in this really critical role that the public, broadly speaking, needs to play in making sure that we protect children in need of protective services. And so we will have many tools proposed, and we will try to balance them all. But this one here with our sovereign nation neighbors and partners, I think it makes a great deal of sense to try to come for some help from AIDS and credits. And we will be working with many other tools in the Health and Human Services Committee, again, to be a productive partner in stepping up our efforts to protect children in need of our supports.
And, Senator Lori, you know that the state had a pilot project with a couple of member bands that were working toward taking over more of the responsibilities of child placement, trying to develop a relationship that would deal directly with the federal government, where progress has been made. We would be encouraging as many of the bands and counties that can to try to look at that model as a way to provide better services for these children and the needs in those communities.
Mr. Chair.
I would encourage that. Senator Gazalka.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Lori, I'm assuming this is true, but are all the bands supportive of this this bill?
Senator Lori.
Mr. Chair, I have not talked to each and every one of the bands, but every one, I have received no opposition to this bill. Several of the bands have come forward and talked to me with strong support, and none have expressed any concerns to me to date. And this has been introduced for some time, I think. Would have found me.
Thank you. And Senator Gazalka, I think that part of the benefit, if we're able to move forward on this, is that we will take some of the conversation between the county and the band and start working on the best services for the children, as opposed to this is it's a financial issue, and we would take some of that issue away. That would be their goal. Anything else, members? Anyone else in the audience that wishes to testify on Senate File 207? Seeing none, no amendments. Chair will lay Senate File 207 over for possible inclusion. Thank you, Senator Lori. And Senator Lori, Senate File 368.
Mr. Chair and members, thank you. This is the reauthorization of a levy for the unorganized township of Sawyer so that Carlton County is able to renew this levy that expired in 2006. The original levy was part of a multi-jurisdictional effort to build the Four Seasons recreational complex in the city of Carlton, and that complex has been a real benefit to our entire region. I've been up and been to many events there, run the 5Ks that start and end there, and been to community events there. It's a real jewel in our region. But it is in need of repairs, and all of the participating entities that would like to support in the repairs of that want to play a partnership role, and this would allow the county, once again, the ability to levy for the support of the improvements needed for that Four Seasons complex. With that, I'll turn it over to the Carlton County Auditor Treasurer, Paul Gassert.
Mr. Chair, members, thank
you. Mr. Gassert, welcome to the committee.
Thank you. As indicated, Carlton County, on behalf of Sawyer, has participated in this entity since 1995. There was another major reconstruction of that facility in the early 2000s, at which time we had sought and legislation wasn't passed. I'm not sure what happened.
And Mr. Gassert, could you state your name for the record, please?
Paul Gassert. I'm the county auditor treasurer for Carlton.
Just to
County.
Help the identifying you later on. Yep. Thank you.
Again, Senator, members, this legislation goes back to the early 90s when they originally participated in the construction of the Four Seasons complex. There was a major renovation in the mid-2000s, at which time Sawyer wasn't able to participate. There are some ongoing maintenance costs to the tune of about $100,000 a year, and they are anticipating some major construction needs with the replacement of the artificial ice system, and I'm sure you've heard about that from other jurisdictions as well. What we are seeking is not only the ability to help with the major reconstruction, but the ongoing maintenance cost. And that's why we're looking for the legislation to pass without a sunset, so we don't have to come back again.
And Senator Lori and Mr. Gassert, we are having conversations about, don't you already have the authority for the county to levy for this? We're not exactly sure why you need this special legislation.
Mr. Chair, members, as my predecessor once said to me, unless the law allows you to do something, you're not allowed to. And we have always been told that for the unorganized townships, at least from what we understand, is that they only have the ability, the county board only has the ability to levy for road and bridge, fire protection, mosquito control, and there are a couple of others. Within Carlton County, we do have a couple other special legislations for the unorganized townships. Sawyer, again, for cemetery purposes. There's an ambulance service that we levy for, but we're under the impression not.
And then so this would be in addition to the list of authority. Okay, we'll check on that. And then are you thinking that this levy would only be on this one unorganized township, or is it going to fall on a larger property tax base?
No, Mr. Chairman and members, this would only be, the county board only has the ability to levy for and behalf of Sawyer Township. The other jurisdictions, none of which are unorganized territories, City of Carlton, City of Thompson, City of Renshaw, Twin Lakes Township, Renshaw Township, all have their own levying authority as it exists today.
And they will be participating in
it. It is my understanding that they are participating in various degrees.
And what you're asking for the cap to be removed, what was your expectation that levy would rise to for this unorganized township?
Mr. Chair, members, the current portion of Sawyer based on net tax capacities, population, everything that we can think of, number of fire calls, number of students enrolled at the schools, is roughly about 5%. So as we go down the road, that may change, but currently it's about 5% of the base that uses that Carlton facility.
And Senator Lori, maybe we'll get some more information on this and put a number in there that they could live with, just because I'm more comfortable with that.
Okay.
Senator Lori.
Mr. Chair, I did get a letter from Auditor Treasurer Gassert that said that the payable net tax capacity for the township is $305,000, and the amount proposed to be levied is still $1,500 and would have an impact of less than 50 cents per $10,000 of home value, if that helps, just to put it in context. So that's in the ballpark of what they're looking for. But if you need to put some amendments on to make yourself comfortable and your committee comfortable, we understand that.
Okay. Any questions, members? Seeing none, anyone else wish to testify on Senate File 368? We'll continue to work on this, Senator Laurie, and see if we can get a little more information and as this moves forward. And I'll double-check on the authority also and make sure that that's required. Seeing nothing else, thank you, Senator Laurie. Chair will lay over Senate File 368 for possible inclusion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Thank you very much. Senator Saxhog. Welcome, Senator Saxhog. Senate File 670 okay to start with?
That'd be just great, Mr. Chair.
Senate File 670.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. Senate File 670, I believe Council has the A1 amendment.
Members, is A1 in your packet?
It's being passed out.
It's being passed out. Let's pass out the A1 amendment. Is this your first stop, Senator Saxhog?
Yes, it is, Mr. Chair.
Senator Reinhart moves the A1 amendment. Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. A1's adopted. Senator Saxhog.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This bill clarifies that communities which exist within 3 miles of an active taconite mine are eligible for taconite aid. Cities are also eligible for taconite aid if they have a taconite concentration produced within their borders. With me today is Lauren Solberg, representing Grand Rapids and Itasca County, to give a brief presentation and help answer any questions the committee might have.
Welcome, former Representative Solberg.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. I'm Lauren Solberg. I'm representing Itasca County and City of Grand Rapids. I also represent Magnetation Mining Company as well. In the current law, there are two parts of the statute that deal with what we call mining effect tax. That's for some aid for cities that have mining operations in or close to their border. The first one is 4.6 cents that are distributed to cities that have a taconite mine and or a concentration or produce concentration within their borders. The second part is if a city or a municipality is within 3 miles of a taconite mine, then it also receives some aid. With new technologies that are being implemented on the range with magnetation is producing concentrate and is mining iron ore, but they do not have a taconite pit or mine as such. They produce just the concentrate. And so without this change, the cities that are under the 3 mile portion of that aid would not be able to receive any of the mining effects tax. This clarifies also that this new technology, where they're just doing the concentration, would also allow those cities that are within 3 miles to be able to have some aid from that particular operation. It clarifies that concentration, it takes concentration from the first portion of the 4.6 cents and puts it also down into the 4 cents for those within 3 miles. So with that and with the additional amendment that is being proposed, there are some other 6 unorganized townships that are just outside the 3 miles that would also be added to that distribution. And
Senator Saxhog or Mr. Solberg, so there's a relatively complicated flow chart that shows the distribution of these production taxes. But just kind of in a a nutshell, what you're doing is you're redistributing the production tax to include some additional areas based on this new mechanism for getting concentrate. And then the result of that is a little less for everybody else, or just less for the DJJ fund, or what exactly is the going on there?
All right. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, it would be, I believe, a little bit less for the DJJ fund and a little bit less for the IRRRB fund as well.
The environmental component.
Yeah, environmental portion of that.
But, Mr. Chair, not but less for each individual.
The other communities wouldn't have any changes.
No. There would be no changes in that. Okay. That's correct, Mr. Chair.
Any questions, members? Senator Gazalka.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If somebody can help me understand the Taconite Environment Fund, and because if we're going to be pulling money from away from that, what is it that they're doing that they're going to get have a million less for? I see the benefit to the cities. I just want to make sure I understand that a little better.
Senator Saxog or Mr. Solberg?
Well, Mr. Chair, Solberg. I'll take an attempt at that. They do economic development issues. They do IRRRB does projects throughout the Taconite relief area for infrastructure grants. There would be a little bit less money for that and a little bit less for the DJJ fund, which is part of the trust fund that exists within the IRRRB.
So, Mr. Chair, testifies either one. Are they supportive of this, or are they neutral, or where are they at on this?
Mr. Chair, I think that they are neutral on that. I've not talked to them specifically about that. This is kind of a fairness issue because the new technology was not anticipated at the time of the adoption of this. As we didn't make that change, Arbo Township, which contains Plant 4 of the magnetation, will receive the 4.6 cents distribution because concentration is the word in that particular part of the statute, but the one right across the road from it would not receive any distribution because they're within the 3 miles, but that's not in their particular city boundaries. So it's a fairness issue, and it also these funds have to be used for only two things, that's my understanding. They can only be used for infrastructure grants and for economic development purposes.
Senator Eaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Solberg, do you know what the balance is in the environmental fund?
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Solberg.
If you'd asked that 3 or 4 years ago, I'd have been able to answer that. I'm sorry I have not been involved in those particular funds lately. I can't answer that honestly.
Senator Eaton.
Mr. Solberg, could you tell me what the charge is for the environmental fund. What is the purpose?
Mr. Solberg.
Environmentally.
Well, Mr. Chair and Senator Eaton, I think there's a general charge in that particular fund for economic development, for improvements to city infrastructure. There's a range of purposes of the fund. It was created actually back in the 40s to begin with, and it was designed to have an understanding that the iron mining industry will probably at some point run out, and it was charged at the time to diversify the economy of northeastern Minnesota.
Mr. Chair, I think that it's misnamed then. It should be an economic fund or something, because my understanding is there's a number of environmental issues surrounding taconite, and it doesn't sound like any of this fund is being used to address it.
Senator Saxog, anything else? Anything else, members? Anyone else wish to testify on Senate File 670? Senator Saxog, we will have further discussions on this bill, would be my expectation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Seeing nothing else, Chair will lay over Senate File 670 as amended for possible inclusion. Thank you, Senator Saxog. Senator Saxog, Senate File 671.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. So Senate File 671, today that we're presenting, and I think Council has an oral technical amendment for us prepared also. So.
Mr. Sylvia?
Mr. Chair and members, there is a typographical error found on page 2 of the bill. The oral amendment would be on page 2, line 19. It would be to delete the second 698 and insert 696.
Senator Marty moves that oral amendment. Any discussion, members? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. The 698 is replaced with a 696. Senator Saxon, what have we got in Senate File 671?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. This bill would add Deer River and Floodwood School Districts to eligibility for aid from the Taconite Relief Fund. With me today again is Mr. Solberg, representing Grand Rapids and Itasca County, to give a brief presentation and help answer any questions the committee may have. I guess I would note on the onset that the reason the Deer River and Floodwood may be considered is that the Itasca County Area School Collaboration, which is all schools in Itasca County and adjacent to Itasca County, have been working very closely as a collaboration, and in order for them to get money from this particular fund, we think it'd be good to have Deer River and Floodwood as part of this.
And Senator Saxog, does this change the distribution to any of the other school districts, or are you just those school districts that are working in this collaborative manner?
No, as with the other one, it doesn't change the distribution to the other school districts.
Okay, thank you. Any questions, members?
I don't think it is, anyway.
Well, we'll find out.
Yeah.
Ms. McQuay.
Mr. Chair and members, the second bullet on the revenue analysis does indicate that it would shift production tax revenue away from school districts currently receiving, because the distribution is capped at 24.72 cents, and so you'd have to take that same amount and distribute it to the two additional schools. Now, there could be some mechanics of it that that you're falling under the 24.72, and there may be some room. That's unclear, but if it is capped out, it would shift it away from other districts.
Thank you, Council. I didn't know that.
So Senator Saxog, it does shift. Okay, thank you, Ms. McQuay. Senator Eaton? No? Senator Senjum, I'm sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Something.
Perhaps this is for our staff. On the last bill, there was a reduction in the Environmental Fund and the Douglas Johnson Fund of $1.6 million. There's also a reduction here in these distributions, but it doesn't say how much. Do we know how much money that is?
Ms. McQuay.
Mr. Chair and Senator Senjum, because the amount is capped, I'm unclear, or the amount of the distribution to school districts under this paragraph is 24.72. It's unclear to me from the second and the third bullet there that this would lower the distribution to the other funds in the same way that the previous bill that we heard would. I certainly am looking into that further to see what that exact number
thank you.
To the DJJ and the Environmental Fund would be.
Anything else, members? Seeing nothing. Anyone else in the audience wish to testify on Senate File 671? Welcome. State your name, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'm John Ungaro, Government Relations Director for St. Louis County. And I guess this will be the first time that I've ever had to testify negatively anyways towards one of my good friend Senator Saxog's bills. So I apologize for that, but
you're forgiven, John.
Okay, thank you. we do have concerns, anyways. And a lot of it goes back to the history of what happened when the taconite relief area was created back in the mid-70s. There was a need amongst the Iron Range legislative delegation to try to draw the boundaries of that as wide as possible. But equally and probably more important was the fact that at that same time, they needed the votes to double the production tax. At the time, the production tax was 62.5 cents a ton. It went in 1977 up to $1.25 a ton. As a result, the communities of Floodwood and Deer River were included to appease, more than anything, some of the other legislators who wanted to make sure that their districts got into the taconite relief area. And so when it came to Floodwood and Deer River, there was a lawsuit that was filed saying that because there was no mineral wealth in the ground underneath those communities, also there had been no mining activity or historic mining activity, no mining facilities built there. Therefore, they should not be part of the taconite relief area. And the courts did decide, yes, indeed, they should not be part of the taconite relief area. And as a result, those two communities were taken out of the TRA. meanwhile, the state, of course, did make sure that for the school districts, the lost revenue that they were no longer getting from the taconite production tax, the state of Minnesota came in and paid, you know, that portion that the state needed to pay to backfill those lost revenues. Another explanation that I have heard from the House author, anyways, of this bill, when I asked him why he is authoring this bill, was that there are a lot of miners, steel workers, that live in the communities of Floodwood and Deer River. And so I had to check with my newest county commissioner in St. Louis County, former Representative Tom Rukavina, who just happens to carry still in his suit coat pocket a lot of files. And he took out a listing of the zip codes of where the steel workers and the various plants actually reside. And the city of Floodwood has zero steel workers living in it, and the city of Deer River has one. In contrast to that, Senator Reinhart's city of Duluth has 51 steel workers living in it who work in one of the taconite facilities, and even Superior in another state across the bridge has four. So as far as the rationale for that, at least what the House author explained to me, I don't think there's any there. The concern from St. Louis County is that last year, as part of Senator Bach's provision in the tax bill that created a new consolidation and cooperation account for school districts, some of the money that went towards creating that account came from the counties. I mentioned earlier that there was back in the 1977, the taconite production tax had been increased to $1.25 a ton. Today, I believe it sits at $2.62 a ton. In 1977, the counties, keep in mind that the production tax is in lieu of property taxes. In 1977, the counties received 26 cents a ton from that production tax of $1.25 a ton. Today, counties are receiving 21 cents a ton from a production tax of $2.62 a ton. We lost a nickel a ton last year when we gave some of our revenues towards that new school consolidation and cooperation account. So I guess our message here today is that before you start expanding any account in the taconite production tax to bring in additional areas, or we go from 15 school districts up to 17 school districts and dilute that pot, as council has stated, that really will be a shift. It will affect those other 15 school districts. They'll be getting less revenue. If there is money available, spare change, so to speak, amongst those 15 school districts that are willing to give up some of that money before they give it to two additional school districts, the counties would like our nickel back that we lost last year in the production tax, and that would include Itasca County as well as St. Louis County, because we were the two that sacrificed the most revenue. That is all. Thank you, members, and I stand for any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Ungaro. First of all, we try not to refer to the other body.
I realize that. I apologize.
In deference to former Representative Solberg, we'll let that go today. I understand the complexity and the negotiations that go on with this distribution. My expectation is that we will have further dialogue before any of these provisions are to move forward. We'll see where all that shakes out. We won't do anything until there's pretty general agreement from members of representing the entire area that they think these are worthwhile and good directions to go. So, anything else, members? Anyone else wish to testify on Senate File 671?
Mr. Chair,
Mr. Solberg.
One particular comment. Always a representative, always a representative, and I remember you and that other body as well.
There's a few
and
of us
others around
here.
This table. It's a good body to be in, right?
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Solberg. Anything else, Senator Saxog?
No. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much. Chair will lay over 671 as amended for possible inclusion. Thank you. Do we have the amendment? Senator Tomasoni, I think we're waiting for an amendment for your bill.
Okay, we're not going to do that one.
You're not?
Not
okay. Senator Tomasoni. Senate File 677.
I do have another amendment, though, Mr. Chairman, that you probably have. Do you have an A1 amendment?
Yes, we do. We will pass the A1 amendment out. This is your first stop, Senator Tomasoni?
I move the amendment.
Senator Senjum moves the A1 amendment. Any discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. The A1's adopted. Senator Tomasoni,
Mr. Chairman,
677 as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, committee members. Senate File 677 is pretty simple, and what it does is it just reinstates a three-year average or a reduction of taxes for companies that want to do direct reduced iron products on the iron range. We're hearing from some of the companies that they may be changing their production from or trying to add to their production, not only just doing taconite pellets, but direct reduced iron pellets that would be able to be used in electric arc furnaces. And by doing this, they have to make a substantial investment in their plants in order to tool them up in order to get the direct reduced iron pellet. The direct reduced iron pellet in this particular bill is 75% iron. The amendment we were waiting for was a little bit less. It was around 67%. We're just trying to find out for sure what the implications are, because a taconite pellet is about 65%. And so it's really, really close to that particular thing. So we want to get a little bit more information before we actually put the amendment on the bill and change it. The other amendment that we just put on the bill is in reference to the occupation tax, and the occupation tax was last year funded some mining, environmental, and regulatory positions over at the, both DNR and PCA in order to help them expedite some permits. And since it was based on a cent per ton amount, it was that could fluctuate. And this basically sets it at either a dollar amount or the cent per ton amount, so that the people who get hired and who are actually doing this work and the agencies that are utilizing this money are know exactly how much they have available. And that way, if the production does go down to a point where the amount of money gets reduced going to the agencies, they don't have to lay these people off that are doing these important things. But I can let Craig Pagel here from the IME.
And so, Senator Tomasoni, so the $1.5 million is comparable what the 2.5 cents was last year?
It might be a little bit more.
A little bit more. Okay. And just briefly, so I kind of have a general understanding, what you're doing here is you're reinstating the phase-in of the production tax for new businesses. Is that what's going on? No?
No. What this is that the provision in law of allowing a phase-in of the production tax on direct reduced iron pellets had expired. And direct reduced iron pellets are a little bit different than the actual taconite pellets. Direct reduced iron pellets have a higher iron content and are used in a different process in order to make actual ingots of iron, so that they can then be used in the electric arc furnaces. Taconite pellets go into integrated furnaces, and so they're a little bit different. So what this is doing is re-upping the incentive of no taxes in the first year of production of the DRI pellets of 25% in the second year, 50% in the third year, and then 75% in the fourth year. So what we're doing is just reopening that particular opportunity for companies if they want to get into the direct reduced iron pellets.
If this bill doesn't become law, the full production tax would fall on them in year one.
Yes.
If this bill becomes law, they get 5 years before the full production tax falls on them.
Yeah, it's either four or five. Yes.
Five. Okay.
But I should also have
Mr. Pagel
talk about the other provision that we just put on the bill.
Chair, members, my name is Craig Pagel. I'm the president of the Iron Mining Association. I brought forward the thought to the Senator Tomasoni that using a per ton cent had the tendency to fluctuate too much to where the staff members that this committee 2 years ago helped bring into being, where both the PCA and DNR worked together on these very complex permits. This does not change any of the permit fees that we'd be paying. What it does is help stabilize those people who are there. And there is a slight increase. That slight increase is due to a couple of different things. One, there is more wetland requirements that they're working on. Two, there's more federal information requests just of this one agency. And there is also more environmental studies that have to be done that aren't directly related to a particular permit. This would help assure that that gets done. The one thing I would like to add, if I could, last year alone, the iron mines paid $101 million in production taxes, which you heard about, which goes to local government agencies. We paid an occupation tax, and that's where this money would be coming out of $15.8 million, and royalties to state-owned lands of $71 million. This would help assure that those taxes royalties are being paid, and it's my understanding those royalties will be going up. The distribution of those royalties and occupation tax, school trust gets $58.7 million, U of M school trust $16.8 approximately, counties get about $3.7 million, and general fund $7.8, almost $7.9 million. So I think this might be a good investment, good return on your investment.
And Ms. McQuay, is there an impact to the general fund if this becomes law?
Mr. Chair and members, the bill itself, as introduced before we put on the amendment, does not have an impact to the general fund. The A1 will have a general fund impact, as Senator Tomasoni mentioned, that it might be slightly larger than the 2.5 cents that was originally in law, to the tune of roughly $500,000 potentially,
three or four,
depending on the production tax, which is what he testified to.
Okay, thank you. Any questions, members? Senator Eaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question is, how does this impact the falling price in taconite and the shutting down of the first plant one of magnetation? Mm-hmm. And I guess I'm trying to figure out why you would want to increase production when the demand is dropping. And my understanding is there's going to be close to 300 million tons of excess product by 2017.
Mr. Chair and Senator
Eaton. Senator Tomasoni.
The issue here isn't the taconite pellets themselves. This is a different type of pellet that goes into a different type of steelmaking product. And so it would have no effect on anything that you asked about, other than it might incentivize a company to change their production of taconite pellets to direct reduced iron pellets. And what's happening in the steel industry, especially in the United States, is that taconite pellets go only to integrated steel makers. And the direct reduced iron pellets, they go to electric arc furnaces, which basically melt scrap and then use the direct reduced iron pellets as another product that they can put into it when the scrap gets really expensive. So this doesn't really do anything other than say that if one of the producers decides to change their production or add to their production from regular taconite pellets to direct reduced iron pellets, that then they get this little bit of an incentive to not pay the taxes on it while they're ramping up to that area. Because it would cost, I think, if I'm understanding it correctly, it would probably cost Cleveland Cliffs on their Silver Bay plant about $69 or $70 million to change over to the direct reduced iron pellet, and they wouldn't stop making the taconite pellet, but they would continue. But they would have a different type of pellet to go into a different type of steel making.
Senator Eaton,
Senator Tomasoni, so these pellets are not in competition with the taconite pellets.
Oh, everything. I think, Mr. Chair and Senator Eaton, I think everything's in competition with everything. This is kind of a direction that the steel industry is going, though, as integrated steel mills start to shut down, and electric arc furnaces are becoming more and more the way of doing things. The producers are thinking of making sure that they have a foot in the market that they maybe not be in right now. Is that pretty good?
Yeah. Thank you.
Anything else, members? Anyone else wish to testify on Senate File 677 as amended? Seeing nothing, thank you, Senator Tomasoni.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Chair will lay Senate File 677 as amended over for possible inclusion. Senator Reinert.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I have with me Daniel Fanning from the City of Duluth. I don't think he has any comments to make, but just
could you pull the mic in just a little bit, Senator
Reiner? Apologies.
Senate File 114.
Senate File 114. Again, good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Daniel Fanning from the City of Duluth. I think he's here just to answer questions if members have any. Members, we addressed this legislation last year. It added a 50-50 food and beverage and lodging tax that had expired. It renewed that in Duluth, and what we want to do with this is just clarify the area of the city that it applies to. The original legislation applied up to 34th Avenue West, moving from the western part of the city. This would extend that to 14th Avenue West, which includes the Lincoln Park neighborhood in Duluth, which we had intended to include. And then, Mr. Chairman, I do have an author's amendment, the A2, that I'd like to put on.
Yes, Senator Reinert moves the A2 amendment. Any discussion, members? It's just a correction of the boundary. Correct. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. The A2 is adopted. Yeah. Thank you, Senator Reinert.
And that's the bill, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Do you have a testifier want to say anything? Travel from Duluth.
Mr. Chair, members, I think Senator Reinert covered it well. We appreciate it. Thank you.
Okay. Anything, members? It's a technical fix, correcting a boundary. Anyone else in the audience wish to testify on Senate File 114? Seeing none, thank you, Senator Reinhart. Chair will lay over Senate File 114 as amended for possible inclusion. Thank you.
Thank you.
Senator Coonan. Senator Coonan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senate File 413.
Senate File 413.
Okay. Thanks, Mr. Chairman, committee members. Senate File 413 simply attempts to ensure that local units of government that host wind farms receive the benefit of the bargain that they struck 15 years ago. When they negotiated the wind generation production tax as the wind industry was expanding. The wind production tax has been a reliable source of revenue for local units of government. However, in the 2008 session, the state policy regarding the treatment of wind generation production tax revenue with respect to levy limits was changed. A production tax revenue was made subject to levy limits, and which had not previously been the case up until then. We do not currently have levy limits in place, but we want to remove this treatment of this source of revenue now so that we're not faced with a problem in the event that levy limits return at some future date. These jurisdictions need these resources to maintain their basic infrastructures, and we don't want to deprive them of this revenue. And Mr. Chair and committee members, I have with me Commissioner Metz from Noble County, and he would like to address the committee on how this affects Nobles County.
Welcome, Commissioner. State your name for the tape, please.
Gene Metz. Mr. Chair, members, thank you for the opportunity to testify in support of Senate File 413. My name is Gene Metz. I am a fourth-generation farmer operating a grain and livestock operation since on my family's homestead farm that they've had since 1908. I'm now in my third year as Commissioner of Nobles County, and I'm here today speaking on behalf of the 18 counties of which make up the Rural Minnesota Energy Board, which is a joint powers board of predominantly southern and southwestern Minnesota counties that have been closely monitoring state policy and local impacts relating to renewable energy development. In fact, it was the Rural Minnesota Energy Board that spearheaded the negotiations 15 years ago to establish wind production tax. Since the establishment of that production tax, wind, and more recently solar, power has become a big presence in our corner of the state. The 18-county Rural Minnesota Energy Board in total contains 1,966 wind turbines, which in 2014 paid roughly $8,940,000 in taxes for production. There are real costs associated with hosting wind and solar projects. Townships and county roads experience significant wear and tear with the movement of construction and maintenance equipment to and from wind and solar farms. We rely heavily on production tax revenue to maintain our county, township, roads, and bridges. The production tax helps maintain strong community support for this energy infrastructure. As Senator Keenan noted, until the 2008 legislative session, wind production revenues were not subject to levy limits. We are not certain why this issue came up late in the 2008 session, but we are requesting that this source of revenue not be subject to levy limits going forward. Many acres of land have been taken out of production, and the economic stimulus the counties and townships have received would be eliminated if a levy were to be imposed, an economic hit our region cannot afford. We respectfully request your support of Senator Keenan's bill, which would revert back to the treatment of production tax revenue prior to the 2008 amendment. Thank you for your consideration.
Well, Senator Coonan, first, as you indicated, levy limits aren't in place. I don't believe this committee is contemplating them. As a former county commissioner, you know, I understand the objection to levy limits. But, I mean, to isolate these particular electrical generation facilities because they happen to have a production tax as opposed to what the other electrical generation facilities currently have, or even what we're contemplating changing the other electrical generation facilities to, we need to have an argument why these production facilities would be treated differently. And I don't, I personally don't see the reason. It's part of the value. If somebody is going to argue for levy limits, it's going to impact the values in all the different jurisdictions. And so we'll have further conversations about this, but my expectation is that we will be treating wind and solar the way we treat other electrical generation. And if the other electrical generation is going to be included in the levy limits, so would wind and solar. Now, from this tax committee, from my perspective, I'm not thinking that levy limits are part of the conversation, but there's other legislators and you know, others bringing issues to bear. So we'll see. But that would be my initial thought at this, Senator Coonan and Commissioner, that we'll be treating all of these facilities the same. And so we'll see where that conversation goes. We're having a pretty good discussion this year about electrical generation and what the nature of that is going to be. And we'll see how this interacts with that. Anything? Senator Coonan.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. I think one of the differences here that you'll see with this type of generation with wind and solar is that they're spread around. And so with other generation, you'll see them concentrated in one area. So there's a less miles of road to maintain and all in that type of thing. But with these, where they're spread out more, you see that you'll pick up extra cost because there's actually more miles of road affected.
No, well, that would be an argument. That makes some sense. Senator Reiner.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was just going to emphasize the point you just made. You know, you've led on this earlier in the session already of sort of taking a look at all of the energy-producing entities in Minnesota, and I thought that report we got was really interesting in how we treat them very differently between wind and energy and water and nuclear and that sort of thing. So, timely conversation.
Yeah. Anything else, Senator Eaton?
I agree.
Anyone in the audience wish to testify on Senate file number 413? Seeing no one, thank you, Commissioner, for coming. Thank you, Senator Coonan. Chair will lay over Senate file 413 for possible inclusion for the conversation. Thank you very much. Senator Coonan, Lucky 7, Senate file 777.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members. And I do have an amendment, the A1 amendment.
The A1 amendment available to be passed out, or is it here? I guess it's in your packets, members.
I have it.
Is this the first stop, Senator Coonan?
Yes, this is it. This
Senator Coonan moves the A1 amendment. Seeing no discussion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. A1 is adopted. Senator Coonan.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members. The 2013 tax bill included an annual inflation adjustment on the excise tax on cigarettes and moist snuff. This adjustment is based on the average retail price of cigarettes. This bill repeals the annual adjustment of the on cigarettes and moist snuff. On January 1st of 2015, the first adjustment took place. The tax rate increased from $2.83 per pack to $2.90 per pack. And what this bill does is the rate going forward will be $2.90 a pack. And so it's not retroactive. It's set at the current rate now at $2.90 and moves forward at that rate.
Thank you, Senator Coonan. So proposing to do away with the inflator on the cigarette tax, leaving it at today's rate. Okay. You have a couple of testifiers?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
And who would you like to go first, Senator Coonan?
I'll go. Good morning. My name
Welcome.
Is Mike LaFave, and I am Director of Fiscal Policy with the Mackinac Center for Public Policy, a research institute in Midland, Michigan. I was invited here today by the Minnesota Wholesale Marketers, Grocers, and Retailers Associations, respectively, and I'm happy to be here. I am the co-author of a peer-reviewed empirical study on cigarette taxes and smuggling in the United States. My co-author, Todd Nesbitt, is an Ohio State University economics professor. Since 2008, we've been following cigarette smuggling in the United States. We actually created a statistical model designed to measure the degree to which cigarettes are smuggled in 47 of the 50 American states. Our 2013 research has been completed and released, and what we found through calendar year 2013 is that Minnesota has a smuggling rate, according to our model, of 18%. That ranks the state 16th highest among the...
Mr. LaFave?
Yes.
There is another bill in the Senate dealing with smuggling. It's in the State Government Finance Bill, I believe, committee jurisdiction. Not in the tax committee jurisdictions, so focus your smuggling and your comments to the issue at hand, which is the inflator on the cigarette tax, please.
Okay. We used our model to do a what-if on cigarette smuggling as it relates to increases in taxes here in Minnesota, and we said, what happens if cigarette smuggling goes to $2, or cigarette excise tax goes to $2.83 per pack? Our model told us that about one-third of the cigarette market in Minnesota would be illegal. That would push Minnesota up our rankings to about fifth in the nation. And then what we did was we said, well, what happens if we push it up just 7 cents to $2.90 a pack? And according to our model, it would increase 0.8 percentage points, the smuggling rate. Now, that might not seem like much, but if that goes on, if that becomes an annual average increase, then I can pretty much guarantee Minnesota would remain a perennial top fiver in our modeling effort. I know that the supporters of these tax hikes are very well-intentioned, but the empirical research done by other scholars seems to suggest that about 85% of the after-tax change in legal paid sales is due to tax avoidance and evasion and not necessarily from quitting. And the even more recent research says that that's probably a low figure.
So. Thank you very much. And so the point you're making is that raising the taxes doesn't generate the revenue because of people are going to be using other mechanisms to get at their cigarette use and not paying the Minnesota tax.
It might not generate the revenue that estimators believe it does. That's one point of it. The other point is that it creates a real illicit market, and so health consequences aren't maybe not be what they seem. Do people quit as taxes go up? Yes, but here on the margin, because taxes have been gone up so much in so many states, that the you've reached the point of diminishing returns on improvements in health, and so additional increases in the excise tax don't necessarily translate to better public health.
Thank you. Questions, Mr. Questions? Nothing now? Senator Eaton.
I can wait till they're done. Thank
okay.
you.
Mr. Bryant?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Tom Bryant, and I'm the executive director of the Minnesota Wholesale Marketers Association. That is a trade association of Minnesota tobacco wholesalers in the state. I'm passing out to you a couple of different documents. One is just a chart showing the current rates for taxation for cigarettes and tobacco products in Minnesota. You'll have that in a second. The other is a colored map. This shows the change in cigarette sales because of the cigarette tax increase that occurred on July 1st, 2013. In your package, you also have a letter from Frank Orton of Orton's Oil. He has 15 convenience stores, one of which is in Moorhead, Minnesota, and the other in East Grand Forks in Minnesota. And after the tax increase, he indicates that the sales of cigarettes in those two stores dropped about 50% in terms of pack sales. Finally, a coalition letter asking you to support Senate File 777 from the Minnesota Retailers Association, the Minnesota Petroleum Marketers Association, the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce, the Minnesota Grocers Association, the Minnesota Service Station and Convenience Store Association, and my wholesale association as well. To my specific testimony, Mr. Chairman, members, Since July 1st of 2013, when the state's cigarette tax was increased by $1.60 per pack, the wholesalers I represent have collectively seen a reduction in cigarette sales of between 25% to 35% to their Minnesota retail accounts. The map I passed out to you is significant. If you have a chance to take a look at that, in Minnesota, on the left-hand border, there are maroon counties in maroon. Those counties have lost 30% or more in terms of cigarette tax paid sales after the cigarette tax increase went through. The rest of the state in the dark pink has lost between 8% and up to 30%. Even more significant are the surrounding states. Those counties in the Dakotas, Iowa, and Wisconsin in light blue have picked up to 10% in sales. The royal blue colors, the medium blue, they have picked up between 10 and 60% in cigarette sales since our tax increase went into effect. And those in the navy blue, the real dark blue, have picked up over 60% in cigarette sales since July 1 of 2013. And that decline in tax-paid sales here in Minnesota is only going to accelerate with the annual increase adjustment. It went up by 70 cents per carton as of January 1st of this year. Also, Minnesota is unique. We're the only state with two annual tax adjustment law requirements on cigarettes, one on the cigarette tax. But Minnesota wholesalers also pay the state sales tax on cigarettes as a part of the tax stamp that we purchased. That sales tax factor also adjusts annually on January 1st. So we have not only one annual adjustment figure, but we have actually two here on one product in the state of Minnesota. My wholesalers are very concerned. They've seen a significant decline in their sales. They've cut costs the best they can. But while they've tried to retain employees in the face of their cigarette sales declines, the ability to do so is made extremely difficult and even more so by the annual adjustment. So we ask you to support Senate File 777. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Beinert. Questions, members? Senator Eaton.
My question is, I don't know where to begin. So the point is that we should subsidize tobacco companies so that we lose $11 million in revenue to the state of Minnesota in 2016-17 and $37 million in 2018-2019 so that more of our kids buy cigarettes.
Senator Cohen.
I'll take that. Mr. Chairman, Senator Eaton.
Mr. Beinert.
In terms of children buying cigarettes, underage minors, the Minnesota Department of Human Services just released a report that according to their SINAR compliance checks, which they are required to do every year in order to receive federal funding for mental health services, 99% of Minnesota retailers pass those tests. Retailers are not selling cigarettes to underage children. We are number one in the nation. If they are obtaining them, they're obtaining them from what we call social sources, older friends, brothers, sisters, parents, even strangers. So retailers and wholesalers are not the source of tobacco products for our underage youth. We don't support that in any way. We don't want to sell tobacco products to underage youth. In terms of subsidizing tobacco manufacturers, these tax increases have directly impacted small family-owned businesses here in Minnesota, both wholesale and retail alike. And those sales have gone elsewhere, simply across the border in a significant extent. And other retailers are then taking the advantage of that. We're at a very competitive disadvantage. This would just give us a small reprieve from a very high tax rate. We will still be number seven in the country for cigarette tax rates here in Minnesota. That's not going to change with the annual adjustment figure being removed.
Senator Eaton.
Thank you. So your argument is that fewer Minnesota cigarette sales results in fewer employees at convenience stores. So by the same logic, am I correct in assuming that your clients also oppose the health gains made by people quitting smoking because it results in fewer health care workers?
Mr. Chairman.
Bryant.
Senator Eaton. There is no argument that some people have quit smoking because of the higher taxes, but the vast majority have moved to other states or other sources or potentially roll your own tobacco to make their own cigarettes because it's less expensive. That is their personal choice. We're looking at the tax impact, which retailers and wholesalers rely on for the sale of tobacco products here in order to keep their businesses and then employ their employees. So that's our concern, is our jobs that we create and be able to retain those jobs.
Senator Eaton.
Thank you. Well, my understanding is the increase with the inflation last year was 7 cents on a pack. I guess I'm a little baffled by that such an issue. We do have fewer Minnesotans smoking, fewer medical costs, and the whole goal, we've spent millions of dollars on smoking cessation in this state. Why would we now spend $48 million in the next 4 years to increase smoking and purchasing of cigarettes? I will not support this bill and will do everything I can to stop its progression.
Thank you. Senator Marty.
Mr. Chair, I think this map, I mean, it's interesting. The places with the darkest blue are the furthest ones from Minnesota in some cases. And I, of course, there's some shifting of things, but the biggest issue is people are smoking less. I mean, I think that's pretty clear. And I think that there is going to be a loss of sales there. And there's going to be a loss, you could argue, again, the same point. I think Senator Eaton sort of made the same point. You could argue there are going to be fewer health care employees needed if we cut health care costs. I guess I just think this is kind of strange to say that because there are fewer sales in Minnesota. And yes, it's a little more in some of the border communities. But bottom line is you're not factoring in, I mean, this factors in so many others. I guess the reason those two counties in western North Dakota have increased is because increase in population of a lot of industrial workers who may be smoking heavily. I mean, I'm not surprised at that, but I think this map takes a look at one part of it, and I think we've got to recognize not only the loss of money to the state, but also the fact that this is having the impact people wanted in discouraging people from smoking and encouraging them to cut down and quit, and I think it's having that impact. So I guess I think this map is not a fair assessment of what's going on.
Senator Reiner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And, you know, Mr. Bryant, I appreciate that you've got a narrow perspective that you need to represent on this issue, and I would just share that, you know, for us, I think we have a broader perspective. I'm sorry. Maybe I'm addressing this to the wrong individual, but you know, the tax on tobacco, in my mind, is not meant to be a general fund revenue generator. It's meant to be a stop smoking incentive. And I've got to be honest. When I look at the map, I think it's working. And the map says to me is that the border states should adopt our policies. You know, and I can't help but note that we're having this conversation with future leaders of our state sitting in the audience. And the last message I want to communicate to them is that I want to help protect the sale of something that kills people. And I get that it has a cost to small businesses on our borders. I represent a border community, and I note that Douglas County, Wisconsin, is one of the darker blue counties. You know, what that says to me is, you know, Douglas County in Wisconsin, you should adopt progressive taxation policies like Minnesota has so that you're moving in the negative direction and not the positive one. And I've had many conversations with my small C stores in the community because of this, and they've given me that argument, and my response is I'd encourage you to look at other products that you can add to your revenue mix that don't end up with a tax burden to every Minnesota of tens of thousands of dollars in health care costs. So, you know, I want to communicate that this bill does have deep concern for me, and that this map doesn't say Minnesota should undo what we've done. It says to me that the border states should take a similar path.
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Bryant.
Senator Reinhart, we're not asking for a reduction in the cigarette tax rate. That'll remain at 290 under the amendment to the bill. So if there is a positive health impact because of the 290 per pack cigarette tax rate, that'll remain. It's just that future increases would not be allowed.
Anything else, members? Senator Sanjom.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is a dicey issue. I'm sitting here thinking about, you know, using tax policy for preventing adversarial issues, whatever they might be. And I don't think we do that very much. I think it's fairly closely isolated to, in this case, tobacco. But we don't put inflators on liquor, I don't think. That's certainly an issue that brings forth a lot of health policy concerns. We don't put an inflator on automobiles. There's lots of people that are killed and injured in automobiles in Minnesota. I just, you know, this is a tax policy, and I'm just thinking in terms of, we can have the debate about, you know, about health care prevention in this committee or other committees, but from the standpoint of health policy, I just don't think it probably belongs in taking care of health matters. Doesn't belong necessarily in health policy. Or tax policy. I think it belongs in prevention and education and things like that. And we're all certainly, you know, opposed to tobacco smoking and so on and so forth. And I think we're doing a pretty good job. But I think we've singled out one product in Minnesota to use to prevent, to use tax policy to prevent smoking. And as I said, we don't do that with any other adversarial issue that we confront within our society.
We have two more questioners, and then we're going to go to further testimony. Senator Marty.
Mr. Chair, just quick response, Senator Centrum. Yes, this may be a health policy discussion. I think Senator Reinert made that point as well. But when you're talking about it, it's been a very effective health policy. I serve on Health and Human Services Committee, and I can tell you this has had more of an impact on public health and smoking cessation than any of the other things we've been doing in recent years. And I think if you talk to some of the medical folks at Mayo, you'll find the same thing. It's had a huge impact on that, and it's a very big public health benefit. And you can say philosophically you don't like tax policy doing that, but we do that in other areas as well.
Chair.
Senator Sanger?
And not to debate, I can't understand, you know, here, you know, whether tax policy is providing the reductions or whether it's good education. I would argue it's probably education.
Senator Eaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would like to point out that unlike a lot of other things, tobacco kills more Minnesotans than alcohol, homicides, car accidents, AIDS, illegal drugs, and suicide combined. This is not just like all the rest of the issues that were addressed. 5,900 Minnesotans die each year from tobacco-related illnesses, and it costs Minnesota $3 billion in health-related costs. This is a unique product that's only purpose is to cause people to be addicted to it and causes a great deal of medical harms. The cost to the state needs to be made up somehow, and the tax provides some of that, and that is the tax policy part. But preventing people from starting is what's going to save our state a lot of money in tax dollars for our citizens.
Thank you, Mr. Bryant and Mr.
Lefebvre.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Ms. Marlinen and Mr. Schaefer. Welcome, Ms. Marlinen. Do you have a handout?
I do, thank you.
Is there a page? Welcome to the Tax Committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Molly Moylanen, and I work for Clearway, Minnesota.
Could you pull the mic in just a little bit?
Absolutely.
Thank you very much.
Our organization is dedicated to reducing tobacco's harm in the state of Minnesota. I co-chair Raise It for Health. We're a coalition of over 30 health and nonprofit organizations that are dedicated to keeping tobacco prices high, a policy approach that is proven to reduce smoking, especially among kids. Our members include the American Cancer Society, the American Heart Association, the Association for Nonsmokers Minnesota, the American Lung Association, Blue Cross Health Partners, the local Public Health Association, the Mayo Clinic, the Minnesota Medical Association, and many others. 2 years ago, lawmakers passed a significant price increase on cigarettes and other tobacco products. Many of you were champions on this historic legislation, and we so appreciate your leadership. The increase you passed is helping to lower health care costs, it's helping to prevent kids from smoking, and it's saving lives. That's why we oppose this bill. Last year, the Health Department released its annual Minnesota Youth Tobacco Survey. It found that in 2014, smoking by high school students fell from 18.1% in 2011 to 10.6% in 2014. This means 20,000 fewer young adults are smoking today than just 3 years ago. Smoking among young adults ages 18 to 24 also dropped from 21.8% in 2010 to 15.3% in 2014. This reinforces previous research showing that young people are the most likely to alter their smoking behaviors in response to price changes. Smoking has also decreased among adults since the tax passed. The new Minnesota Adult Tobacco Survey found that adult smoking rate fell from 16.1% in 2010 to 14.4% in 2014. This research shows direct role of the tobacco tax in helping smokers quit. Smokers reported that the tax increase influenced their smoking. 60% of smokers thought about quitting, 48% cut down, and 44% tried a quit attempt. In addition, the majority of people who successfully quit said the tax helped them. More than 60% said they made a quit attempt because of the tax and that it helped them to stay tobacco-free. These surveys add to the mountains of research that already exist, showing that cigarette price increases reduce smoking. Changing the law now would chip away at the historic achievement you made in 2013. And this policy really only benefits cigarette companies, an industry that has its eye squarely on kids and other vulnerable populations, its targets, with its deadly and addictive products. An annual increase will keep the tobacco tax from slipping, which will prevent more kids from starting and prevent former smokers from relapsing. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Mylan. And just so we're clear, nobody's proposing to repeal the current tax. We are addressing the inflator that would be going forward, which is a 7 or 8% impact going forward. Nobody's proposing repealing the tax that occurred. Mr. Schaefer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Matt Schaefer. I'm with the American Cancer Society Cancer Action Network. We'd like to echo the concerns shared by Ms. Moylan and offer just a little bit more information. In previous sessions, I have stated on record that tobacco use is responsible for about one-third of every cancer-related diagnosis in this country, and now we know that may have been an understatement. About 2 weeks ago, the New England Journal of Medicine published a study conducted by our organization presenting evidence that smoking alone may cause tens of thousands more deaths per year than what the Surgeon General currently estimates. To provide some context, Surgeon General currently estimates about 480,000 deaths per year across our country. We believe that might be closer to 550,000. The reason that our coalition advocated for raising the price of tobacco products is, and as well as a bill being discussed today, is because we know that raising the price of tobacco is the most effective way to break the cycle of addiction and preventable disease. It's our understanding that the revenue note of about $11 million in the first biennium assumes that 3 million more packs of cigarettes will be sold if this bill passes. That number in our eyes means more cancer. That means more health-related expenses that could have been avoided. Now, nobody wants to see Minnesotans pay a tobacco tax less than our organizations. We simply have a difference of opinion on how to get to that objective. We want people to quit. We don't want them to start. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Questions? Senator Sundrum.
Thank you very much for testimony. And again, you know, just for the record, none of us, you know, want to see tobacco usage. But when you think about it from your perspective, education versus taxation, does one rise above the other in terms of value, in terms of how to approach this?
I can do it. Mr. Chair, Mr. Sundrum. Our organization takes an evidence-based approach to this issue, and we believe that it is equally important. Prevention, education efforts, raising the price of tobacco products, as well as smoke-free restaurants, workplaces. We believe that those three policy changes in tandem will lead to bringing down the level of smoking, which Ms. Moylan had spoke to.
Senator Sundrum.
I'm not being facetious when that, you know, if this is really effective, you know, should we in fact double or triple the annual rate of inflation in terms of taxation? Or maybe better so, would you support just the abolition of tobacco sales in Minnesota? I mean, I'm not so
Senator
sure
Senator.
We wouldn't have votes in the legislature to do that.
Ms. Mylan?
Mr. Chair, Senator Sundrum, as Mr. Schaefer said, both of our organizations are really science-based organizations. We follow an approach proven to prevent kids from starting to smoke. and the best evidence shows it's all about increasing prices, smoke-free spaces, prevention and cessation services. So that's really the three-prong approach that we're going to continue to pursue to reduce tobacco use in the state.
Okay. Senator Eaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would like to point out the disparities involved in tobacco smoking and the resulting cancer, that the tobacco companies are disproportionately targeting low-income and minority Minnesotans, and so they disproportionately die from diseases like emphysema and cancer. African-American men and women in Minnesota are 36% to 30% more likely to die of lung cancer than non-Hispanic white men and women. Diseases from commercial tobacco use, such as heart disease, cancer, diabetes, stroke, and lower respiratory disease, are the leading cause of death for American Indians in Minnesota. Low-income smokers suffer disproportionately from the health effects of smoking and are 70% more responsive to price increases.
Anything else, members? Anyone else wish to testify on Senate File 777? Mr. Cummings? Thank you, Mr. Schaefer. Thank you, Ms. Mullinan. Mr. Cummings.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Paul Cummings, and I'm the Tax Policy Manager at the Minnesota Department of Revenue. I first wanted to say that we don't have a comment at this time related to the policy behind this bill. I just wanted to clarify some things that were brought up in the record. The first, Mr. Chair, was there was a question about our estimates at the Department of Revenue related to the cigarette tax increase. And at times at the Department of Revenue, you talk to some of our nonpartisan researchers, and they come and they say things like, we got it right, right? And in this was one of those cases where they were right on related to the cigarette and the tobacco estimate that happened in the 2013 bill. So I just wanted to clear the record here that the estimate was right on. Now, there was a projected reduction in the purchases of tobacco, and it was not attributed in any specific way, but the estimate was right on. Secondly, I just wanted to say that, you know, the issue of smuggling has come up in connection to tobacco. I wanted to say that what we're finding is a real connection with tobacco rather than with cigarettes. Minnesotans are legally allowed to bring in a carton of cigarettes from an adjoining state. But what we're finding is with the tobacco, you know, the other tobacco products, they are coming in. We've seen pallet loads and others that we have found and that we're trying to think about solutions to deal with. So that is something that you mentioned, Mr. Chair, is in a different committee that we're trying to deal with. We're finding a rate of seizures that's increasing over time. And there are a number of different solutions that people have brought up. You know, in the bill, we're talking about some penalties, talking about a retail license. Something that's not in the bill would be stamping tobacco products. That's another something. We find that the stamping of cigarette products is very effective in making sure that the tax is paid. So that is something, that's a step that we did not take, but it was something that was brought up in discussions about that type of behavior. So I just wanted to correct the record about a number of topics brought up today.
Thank you, Mr. Cummings. Senator Marty.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Cummings, just a question about your last point. This other bill which the chair mentioned, and I'm not familiar whose bill or what committee or whatever it's in, but so I'm sure we'll be seeing that later. But this tax stamping portion, I know what a cigarette tax stamp is.
Right.
The other types of tobacco, loose tobacco, snuff, other things are not stamped at all. How do you catch it then?
They're not,
Mr. Cummings.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, they are not stamped, but they are taxed. And so we do require receipts if we're going out and auditing to make sure everything's make sure that the tax has been applied. And in many cases, they are. I'm not trying to suggest that, you know, we have hundreds of retailers and wholesalers across the state that are working to make sure that there's a marketplace that's based on a level playing field of people paying their taxes. But in the tobacco part, we are finding places in which there are cracks, and that is where we're trying. That is why you know, the Department of Revenue and the administration has brought forward a proposal on smuggling.
Senator Marty.
One more, because I'm not, again, I don't understand how it's all, how you catch, how you track that, how you tax it, and so on. But in terms of the tax stamping thing, do some states do the stamping and others, we do not, you're saying, for anything other than like cigarettes?
Mr. Cummings.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, there is a cigarette stamp. The other types of tobacco products are not stamped. I'm going to get back to you on the practices in other states. We can certainly get back to you on that. But we know that that is, you know, that the tax for the other tobacco products is applied at the wholesale level. We have many, many wholesalers in the state working to do that, and I know that they rely on a marketplace where everyone else is doing that as well. And we wanted to make sure that there is a marketplace where everyone's paying the appropriate amount of tax.
But, Mr. Chairman, in other words, but stamping it, you'll check on what other states, I appreciate that. Yeah,
I will.
But stamping, and again, I don't understand how the process works or anything, but that would help make sure there's, that would help address the smuggling issue you're saying.
Senator Marty, we've had some conversation about stamping of tobacco products in previous years. One of the issues that, at my recollection, comes is they end up hand stamping because they're of ununiform size and shape, which gets to be complex or problematic for the marketer because they can't automatically do it.
Mr. Chair, Senator Marty, remember that. Would love to discuss it more with you sometime.
Yes, sure. Anything else? Anyone else wish to testify on this Senate file? Seeing none, Senator Coonan, any closing comments?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Coonan.
And I know this, I'm not surprised that this bill brings up some really strong feelings. It's something I was actually expecting, and there's very good arguments that have concerns with this bill. I understand that. But anyway, I would also like to point out that this is a regressive tax, and for people who are smoking that are struggling with quitting and haven't been able to quit, the higher tax rate, I believe, kind of takes advantage of their addiction as far as tax collection. And I understand that's not the purpose that cigarette tax was increased for in the first place. And also, Mr. Chairman, as you mentioned, this is not a repeal. The tax on cigarettes goes ahead at $2.90 a pack, which is the highest rate we've ever had. And so I would like to make that clear. This is not a repeal. It deals just with the indexing. Now, on the subject of the indexing and tax policy, there again, I think that this is something the tax committee has a responsibility for keeping an eye on. So as we move into the future, and if there are individuals and groups that feel that a higher tax on cigarettes is proper, I think that direct and probably a better way to handle it is to come to the committee and argue the case for a higher tax rate instead of having the inflator in the statute. But again, I understand everybody has a lot of members have strong feelings on this, and I sure understand that.
Thank you, Senator Coonan, and you bring up a good point about the value of the legislature revisiting these issues to ensure that they're doing what we intended for them to do. So that's certainly a value. Anything else, members? Seeing nothing else, thank you, Senator Coonan. Chair will lay over Senate File 777 as amended for possible inclusion. Members, we've got three committee minutes. We are getting caught up on our minutes, so I would like to
I'll move to approve.
Yes, thank you. Senator Reinhart moves approval of the February 10th, the February 19th, and the February 23rd minutes. If you would review them briefly to make sure they're accurate. All those in favor of approving the minutes, respond with aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. These 3 minutes are approved. Thank you, members. Members, next week the division will be meeting on Tuesday and Wednesday. Full committee will be meeting on Thursday. I believe we're doing a variety of Member bills and division, we'll be doing commissioner confirmation on Thursday, and I believe one member. We'll have some conversation about the railroad proposal of Governor Dayton's on Thursday. Anything else, members? Seeing nothing else, committee is adjourned.